Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
If economic growth only measures the measurable things, we could have a flourishing society where there are more and more of the qualitative things that actually make life rich, but they're just not in a market. So I'm not talking about economic stagnation. I'm not talking about, you know, social stagnation or cultural decline. It's more of a shift away from the quantitative and the standardized, the commodified, the outsourced, more toward the personal and the unique and the authentic and the qualitative.
That's today's guest on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. The noted and very popular inspirational speaker and author, widely known for his book Sacred Economics, about money and society, Charles Eisenstein. Hello, and welcome to another edition of It's Our Money. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute. This week, Ellen will talk with Charles Eisenstein about some deeper considerations and analysis about what money is and how it can be reimagined as an energy source and driver of a new era of social and human development and expression. Now, that may sound a bit theoretical for you, but this is, after all, a program about our money. And when we look at how money is currently deployed across societies the world over, it's readily apparent that some systemic changes are needed to straighten things out. Does money have to be the bottom line of quantifying social benefit? Or are there more important and more accurate denominators of what we should consider as we watch local economies the world over sink beneath huge debt loads to global banking interests that are robbing them of their assets and their livelihoods? Joining the discussion today will be a return guest, Ellen's daughter, Jamie Hansen Brown, a biomimicry expert who's considering how our systems of money are having an evolutionary moment in which a very big shift is occurring right under the eyes of the big financial markets. And speaking of that, it's been a tough year so far for that global bank crowd, as markets the world over are dipping to lows that haven't been seen since the collapse of 2008, which are stirring deep fears about what we might be facing in the near future. If the financial matrix we've all been stuck with lets us down again, how will and how should we respond? Meanwhile, as the global banks face the rightful comeuppance of any overinflated, arrogant player, there's good news on the people's banking frontier coming out of Santa Fe, New Mexico, which this week announced the results of a 10-month study of what a public bank might be able to do for their city, which, like so many other towns and cities across the country, are faced with re-examining their money resources and their policies about money management. We'll speak with the leader of Banking on New Mexico, Nicole Lykin, who helped lead the effort in Santa Fe toward creating a new public bank. And we're going to revisit some of the grounding principles of why Santa Fe and all Americans should give pause to the nature of our anti-democratic money trap. We'll bring back some commentary from our dearly beloved and departed Craig Barnes, who spoke with us well over a year ago about what motivated Santa Fe to examine the prospect of creating a city-owned public interest bank. And speaking of change, Ellen's latest article, entitled Breaching the Citadel, is yet another indicator that significant changes are afoot in our monetary land of Oz, and you all better be paying attention.
The news in the stock market and the money markets around the world in the past week are not a good indicator of the start of a new year. In fact, it looks like things are getting to be very troubled. It makes me think of your comment about a bank crisis every 7 years. Here we are, 7 years later. Is that your sense?
Yes, many people are predicting an even bigger bust than the last one because we have the derivatives pyramid is growing. Some people say it's as much as 3 quadrillion or 2.5 quadrillion. I mean, it's like impossible numbers that you can't even picture. And what does that even mean? So the banks and the big players are playing in a casino instead of putting their loans into infrastructure and businesses and productive things. So what we have is money making money off of other people who are losing money without actually building anything. So the economy itself is languishing while you have more and more money going into the derivative scheme, which is inherently unsustainable. I mean, the whole nature of it is ultimately unsustainable.
If 40% of our economy is financial profit, then that's just paper.
Yeah. Well, and who are they making the profit off of? They're taking it out of the real economy. They're taking it away from the workers and the people that actually earned it.
Yeah. So they're not putting it into infrastructure, as you said, and yet your article this week, which is called The Citadel is Breached, talks about that even our Congress, do-good activist Congress, has come up with a way to finance infrastructure, even though it's a piddling sum. But what do you mean by breaching the Citadel?
Well, they've actually been arguing over this for a decade. Like, both parties agree that our infrastructure is falling apart and we have to do something about it, but they can never agree on how to fund it. So now they've come up with a way. They did tap into the Federal Reserve, which is... that's what I'm calling the Citadel. It looks kind of like a Citadel. Up till now, you know, they've called themselves an independent central bank. Actually, that's only been since the 1970s. It used to be in the 40s that central banks actually were part of the government and actually served the government and worked for the government. But in the 70s, they decided to declare their independence, which meant they were independent of government, although they weren't independent of the other big banks, as Tim Canova points out. I mean, they're always catering to somebody's will. If it's not we the people, it's the banks, and that's who they are catering to now. So Congress voted to tap partly into their reserves, which they don't really need. I mean, what does the central bank need reserves for when it has the ability to create money? And even Ben Bernanke admitted that they don't need the money. That he said it just looks bad, but that they didn't really need these reserves.
It looks bad that they give us money for infrastructure.
Right, for something useful, yeah, like infrastructure, instead of just shuffling it around in their own reserve accounts where it never gets out into the real economy. So
yeah.
It was partly that, and partly the 6% dividend that the big banks have been getting for the last century. You know, ever since 1913 when the Federal Reserve was set up, the member banks got 6% dividend every year, which might have been reasonable when interest rates are higher, but now 6% for doing nothing is a bit outrageous. So it's down to like 2.2%. This is the dividend that the member banks get for being shareholders in the Federal Reserve.
I see.
So they're cutting into that dividend, which has been sacrosanct, never been cut before.
Do you think that this is the possible opening? Is this, in fact, really a breach in the Citadel's walls?
Well, what I was writing about was that it's really just sort of a hole in the wall, and what we really want is to see a flood. I mean, they've got the flood in there. They've got oceans of potential wealth that could be tapped, and it seems to me should be tapped. They have the power to issue money, but they've made us think that we're broke, when in fact the government could be issuing all the money we need for practical things like infrastructure and social services, things that the money would actually come back to the government. These are, in the 1930s, they were called self-funding loans. So you fund things like farms and dams and bridges and things where you get the money back from that. So what you're doing basically is putting the money out there, build the thing with the money, pay the workers, pay the materials, and then the thing itself that you just built provides enough profit that it pays the loan off. So it's rather like what banks do, you know, where they issue credit and then you use the credit to build something or do something and then you pay it back with the proceeds. You're not just pumping money out there and pumping and pumping and it goes out and out and doesn't come back. You're putting it into things that will return money. And there were a couple of studies that I cited that were European that showed that you actually get close to 3 times as much in GDP. One said 2.3 times, and one said 2.8 times as much in GDP as the money you put out there for infrastructure. So if you're actually getting more GDP back, that means you're tripling the supply or doubling the supply for the money you put out there. So you've got twice as much supply as demand, which means prices are going to go down. They're not going to go up.
It's too bad they don't understand this as well as you do.
Yes, we do. One person who does understand it is Tim Canova, who I quoted in that article, but he's running against Debbie Wasserman Schultz in Florida. So he would actually revive such an idea, putting quantitative easing into infrastructure, having the central bank or the treasury printing the money for infrastructure. So that would be totally cool to have a sharp, intelligent professor type.
I've had a high regard for Tim Canova for years, but I think I'm questioning his judgment now that he wants to run for Congress.
That's true.
We'll have to talk to him about that a little bit. Listen, it's been a big week for public banking. Any brief comment? We're going to talk about that in a little bit, but any comments about the Santa Fe development?
Well, that's really great that they have a feasibility study and that it seems to be capturing minds. I mean, people are quite impressed and all set to run with it.
Well, it's very encouraging, and it's a nice way to start the new year, at least for us. Even while the big banks are going down, it sounds like public banks might be coming up. All right, Ellen, well, thank you very much, and we'll look forward to the conversations coming up here.
Okay, likewise. Thanks a lot.
Before we get to Ellen's interview with Charles Eisenstein, we want to ask Nicole Lykin in Santa Fe a couple of questions about the outcome of that feasibility study I mentioned earlier, the first government-sponsored official examination about what impact a public bank could have on their local economy.
So, Nicole, congratulations on what has developed in the last week as the Santa Fe concluded its feasibility study. What now actually has been accomplished with that?
Well, it is an official document that's been accepted by the city that shows a path forward for how a public bank could happen economically. It addresses economic modeling primarily and a little bit about governance in terms of boards and oversight. There does remain a lot of work and consensus building to happen in the community, and that should happen, we hope in the next few months we'll really begin that process. We're very glad that the release came out and that people will have this time to study and look at it. And we're going to be meeting with counselors to help them understand, and that should help us also.
What kind of indicators do you see in terms of the prospect of the financial prospects for the city?
It does show that it can reduce the debt burden that the city is experiencing and has been experiencing. Right now, they're really overwhelmed with the debt they've got because they're having difficulty making payments on it because there's not enough income. Employees have been cut from state staff because we're the state capital a lot. There have been a lot of budget cuts with the state as well, and so that really affects us.
So one of the models that was used was the in-house refinancing of bond debt. Would you tell us a little bit about what those numbers look like in this very initial assessment?
What she estimates over a seven-year period is that there would be a $24 million benefit to the city of Santa Fe. Basically, there would be a central financial management authority within the city to lend within the city and to pay off debts.
Not and a public bank per se.
We think of a public bank as being something with a charter that has all the benefits and bells and whistles that a bank can offer, but other people evidently think a bank can be just good financial internal management. And so the good internal financial management doesn't require a license or a charter and can just begin immediately for the city as a way to save money and to turn some of that profit back to themselves, because they'll lend the money between departments, but they'll charge the department's interest. But it'll be lower interest than what they're currently paying when they do bond debt.
So there are no immediate plans for capitalization of a separate entity.
Her model looks at 7 years and proposes that a public bank start no later than 3 years. our model that we have, that we're looking at, starts a public bank in 2017, and it might meet somewhere in between 2017 and 2019 that a bank actually gets off the ground. What we're hoping to do is start the discussion for what it will take to charter a bank and to take time so that the community really understands that and has buy-in on that, and that the mission is established, that governance issues are very clearly defined so that the community understands that the city won't be running the bank.
Right.
But the internal function of financial management, the city will be running that. One of the things the consultant proposed was an oversight board that would provide transparency and accountability to the public of the internal operations of the city.
Right. So the trust issue is really that with the role of government and the government's ability to responsibly conduct its fiscal affairs. Well, Nicole, thank you very much, and congratulations again on getting this next very big step complete, and the outcomes very encouraging to all of us who are watching around the country to see how this process will unfold and be realized. So
I think there'll be a lot of different kinds of processes and different ways to approach this depending on the community. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what other communities do with their process.
That's Nicole Lykin of Santa Fe's Banking on New Mexico Public Banking Committee.
My guest today is Charles Eisenstein, a very popular inspirational speaker and writer on economic reform. He is the author of 6 books, including Sacred Economics, Money, Gift, and Society in the Age of Transition. He has a huge fan base, including my daughter, Jamie, who is going to join me on the line. So it's great to be talking to you both, Charles and Jamie.
Always a delight to spend time with you, Ellen.
So the idea of economics as something sacred is a brilliant shift in paradigms, and I want to get into all that. But first, I wondered if you could share some of your personal story. We were reading your bio, and we're really struck by how you came to this work and arrived at where you are today. I'm sure a lot of young people can relate, including my own kids.
I think, like a lot of people in my generation, what I call the old story, the normal life trajectory, doing the things you're supposed to do to be a success and to contribute to society, those were not very attractive to me. So I took an alternate route. I didn't even go to graduate school. You know, I went to Taiwan. I was a translator for a while, did a lot of reading, absorbed Eastern philosophies, and I just never could make myself go along with the program. Not that I had at the beginning any coherent intellectual critique of the program. It was this kind of mute rebellion against something that I felt was wrong, like on a body level. And I could half-heartedly go along with it, but I never was able to, and I, you know, I saw this as a flaw, as laziness, procrastination, or just not having my shit together. But I think that the old story or the, quote, normal life is getting less and less attractive to more and more people, especially as, you know, today, even if you play along with the game and do your best to be a good little boy or girl, you still don't get the rewards that were promised you. So there's a push out of the old story and out of the old economy, and then there's a pull towards something that feels right and beautiful to us. You know, in broad strokes, that was my story as well.
Mm-hmm. And you call your approach sacred economics, which I think is a great concept, but it sounds like a contradiction in terms. Do you want to talk about how you got there and what you mean by that?
Sometimes I joke that the sacred part of the title turned off half the audience and the economics turned off the other half of the potential audience. One time someone said that they just got an F on their grad school paper because they cited my book. And the professor got upset about it. But then, you know, on the other hand, I get mostly renegade economists writing to me and saying that they appreciate my book. So anyway, the idea of sacred economics, basically the question is, what would it take for money and economic life to be aligned with what is sacred to us and not opposed to it? It's just that simple. Because today, very often, the best financial decision or the most secure decision goes against what is exciting to us, what makes our hearts sing, you know, what we're called into service to do. The big money isn't in, you know, ecosystem restoration. It isn't in holistic healing or in acts of kindness and charity. You know, the big money is in ecosystem destruction, not what we really believe in. And so because money ultimately is just a story, it's a system of agreements about value and exchange, I think, well, the story could be changed into something that is aligned with what we really care about.
Mm-hmm. Jamie had a similar experience with, she did her master's thesis at London School of Economics on basically on the sort of thing I was talking about in Web of Debt. And it didn't fly too well with her professors. It was like the worst bridge. I don't know if you want to go into that, Jamie, but I know it's difficult to do something to break out and still stay within the system. And both my kids have found that too. But it's really not only brave of you to have struck out, but you've done so well with it. I mean, you're obviously striking a chord with a lot of people because a lot of people resonate with what you say. And I think it's partly because you say it so clearly and you don't just, you know, take a thesis and then defend it. You look at the other side. And I mean, I think you're very, very open-minded in your approach to things. I've just been really impressed. I've been reading just lately just to get ready for this interview, and mm-hmm. I've just been totally impressed with what you've written. Another concept that's a little might need defining, you call yourself a degrowth activist. Do you want to say what you mean by that?
As you know, our current system has a grow or die imperative built into it. Essentially, I think you've written about this too. You know, essentially, mm-hmm. When money is created as interest-bearing debt, then the total level of economic activity really has to grow more or less as fast as the rate of interest. Otherwise, you get concentration of wealth, rising bankruptcies and defaults, and systemic breakdown. And so when every time the economy slows, then there's a crisis. So that would be fine, actually, if the economy were growing continually and forever and rapidly. The system would work. But we live on a finite planet.
Mm-hmm. Which it has done, yeah, for millennia, but we're kind of at the end of the line.
But we're reaching some limits. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a somewhat sophisticated argument. You know, it's not only ecological limits to growth, it's also social limits to growth. The ecological limits are pretty obvious, but people say, well, you know, we could grow the service economy instead. We could have ephemeralization and miniaturization and use fewer resources and keep growing forever. But I think that there are limits to the service economy as well, because ultimately it goes back to what economic growth really is. It is the growth in goods and services that are exchanged for money. So if I'm out there, I had been in a coma and not contributing to the economy, and then I woke up and I had this spiritual epiphany, and I start bringing blankets to homeless people and holding their hand and talking to them, and 24 hours a day I'm active and creating a better world, that does not count as a good or a service unless I'm being paid for it. So when we measure GDP, we're measuring financial transactions, ultimately. And for that to happen, for that to grow, essentially life functions that had not been in the money realm have to migrate into the money realm. So we see over the last 50 years, the most economic growth has been in things like childcare, food preparation, medicine. Many of these things were things that people used to do for themselves, house cleaning, you know, lawn care. And when everyone mowed their own lawn and then started hiring lawn services, that counted as growing the economy. So there's a limit, I think, to the life functions that we can outsource. And the more of them we outsource, the less sovereign we feel, which is contrary to economic dogma that says the more that you outsource, the better off you're going to be, because you're going to have more time to engage in your specialty and create more value and so on and so forth. So anyway, it's a kind of a long, the degrowth argument isn't a trivial argument, but I think we're seeing the proof of it in the global slowdown in growth, despite the best efforts of policymakers to keep the economy growing. And so I ask, well, if economic growth only measures the measurable things, we could have a flourishing society where there are more and more of the qualitative things that actually make life rich, but they're just not in a market. So I'm not talking about economic stagnation. I'm not talking about, you know, social stagnation or cultural decline, but it's more of a shift away from the quantitative and the standardized, the commodified, the outsourced, more toward the personal and the unique and the authentic and the qualitative. Yeah,
I've also written on the fact that the problem is that all money is created as debt. You know, it's all just balance sheet stuff today. There's nothing substantial behind it. It's except the full faith and credit of we the people. Mm-hmm. And that if all money is created as debt and more has to be paid back than was created in the first place, clearly we've got a problem, and that's why we have this huge debt problem today. But money reformers have gotten all over my case, and they say, no, the debt virus theory has been debunked. That's not true. The money is there to pay because money is a flow. It still just seems to be instinctively true that the problem we have here is that they're always wanting more money back than they put out there. There are some other things that you've delved into in your book that I thought were really interesting. But first, I thought I would give Jamie a chance to jump in. We were talking yesterday about how similar your views are to biomimicry, which is something I've interviewed her on this program before, so our listeners probably know what we're talking about here. So, Jamie, do you want to comment on some of that?
Sure. We were talking in particular about how you have envisioned what you described in Sacred Economics as decentralized, self-organized, emergent, peer-to-peer, ecologically integrated expressions of political will. And in parallel to that, an ecology of money as well, an economic system with many complementary modes of circulation and exchange. That description is really close to an articulation of natural system design. And the biomimicry community that I work with describes natural systems as bottom-up, self-organized, decentralized, diverse, locally attuned and adapted, so a kind of permaculture of smaller systems nested within larger systems. And so those are the characteristics that we're always looking for in human systems that make them consistent with natural systems, at least in terms of their design characteristics. And so those are also the characteristics that have led us to develop a focus on mutual credit solutions, because they're the most bottom-up and localized monetary solutions that we've found. So I love that aspect of your vision. And I'm particularly interested in the bottom-up solutions. How is it that we can localize and democratize our monetary solutions so that we can take direct responsibility as individuals and communities for issuing credit and for implementing solutions, as opposed to handing over that authority to governments or to banks to implement the solutions for us, to issue credit for us?
So the thing about mutual credit, I think in any system, whether it's centralized or bottom up, you have to have the principle of inclusivity, of radical inclusivity, also has to be balanced with some kind of exclusivity, some kind of maintenance of boundaries. And perhaps
could you define those terms?
Well, I'll get to it in a second, you know, because perhaps we've lived in an age that has been overly rigid and controlling. And I mean, there's kind of a spiral dynamics theme here, you know, that a counter-reaction to that is the desire to obliterate all boundaries and all hierarchies and all structures, which might be a salutary response. But when you try that, ultimately you discover, so to take the example of mutual credit, you discover that there has to be some way to decide who gets credit and who doesn't, and how much credit they can get. So one way to do it, of course, is to have a limit on how much into the negative one participant is allowed to go. But there may be times, and that might work fine, you know, for like small scale stuff, but what if we want to scale it up to allow large capital projects? Then you're going to need to have exceptions to that, where some entity can go much deeper into debt to create something that's for the good of the community. So once you start treading that territory, you come to a place where you have to have some mechanism, some committee or some person or some process or maybe some algorithm, but I'm pretty skeptical of that, that determines who gets allocated how much credit and under what circumstances. And guess what? That's what a bank is supposed to do. We're already back to a bank. So the question for anything beyond like the simplest mutual credit systems, there's an inescapable question. And so for me, it's not, can we have a system without banks? But it's more, what new structures of banking are in alignment with the natural world, with ecological thinking, with what we are learning about systems thinking, with our democratic and egalitarian impulses? What's the new story of banking? Not how can we eliminate all hierarchical structures. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I mean, definitely to me, because that's my thing is public banking. We need the banks. That's what their function is, to determine creditworthiness. If all money is IOUs and you wrote an IOU to your grocer, he's not going to take it because he doesn't know you personally. At least my grocer doesn't know me personally in a big city. So you go to a bank, which will determine who you are, how you're going to pay it back, and they'll make sure you pay it back. So like in a community currency system, there's no big enforcer that has the ability to come after you if you don't pay or what. So that's
future,
what we need banks for. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe in the future, those questions that you just mentioned that a bank asks, maybe those would be different questions. You know, it might be also, is this person going to use the money responsibly for the benefit of the community, for the benefit of the bioregion? Like those questions could be integrated into a new story of banking.
Yeah, and that's actually what they do at the Bank of North Dakota. I mean, they have, because they have a charter that's geared toward serving the local economy, the public interest, then they do give the low interest loans to those particular things that they support, which is education, agriculture, energy. You know, things that they need for their, so you could, and of course that's what in Asian countries, that's what they've done for a long time, is have these sort of long range plans where there are certain things that they target and they give credit to those things more than to other things. Might not agree that they're the most sustainable things, but that is a way to set up a banking system where if you have a public system, you can better control where the credit goes. That's one problem with our current private system, is that the things that get credit are the big crony capitalist gambling derivatives, hedge funds, the things that make money, but they don't necessarily do good for the economy. We could control that if we owned the banks. Oh, another thing that you've addressed really well, that I'm going to Europe next month, and I'm sure I'll be looking at this, and I want to be totally friendly to the 100% reservers, but I agree with you that the system is really nothing new. It's a repeat of what we have with sort of a different lens on it, as Jamie would say. Do you want to explain your refutation of the 100% reserve solution?
Let me say for one thing that I'm very happy with any experimental idea.
Uh-huh. Yeah, me too. I love the fact that they're talking
reserve, like,
about
like,
it. Yep.
Yeah, I'm like, that's cool. You know, that's a good thing to try. Because
it really
shakes up our thinking. And I don't think that the more beautiful financial system of the future is going to be something that some smart guy or gal sits down and creates the blueprint of it because they're just so intelligent, you know. And I think it's going to come through an organic evolutionary process, an emergent process. And no one right now.
Experiments, yeah. Trial and error.
Trial and error and stuff isn't going to work. And we're going to learn from that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there's in this money world, in this kind of alternative economics world, there are just like so many people who are so identified with their ideas and being right about them. And I'd like to see a much more playful and gentle spirit in it. Maybe it's
that's
because
what's
it attracts.
That's so cool about your work. Yeah, I mean, and the way you write, it's great. So in the 100% reserve solution, banks would not be allowed to create money in the form of relending their deposits
right.
or use their actual deposits for loans.
Yes.
But
yes,
they would be able to relend their savings, money in the savings accounts. So these are people that know that they're taking a risk. They could actually lose their money if it's a bad bet. The theory would be sort of like you're an investment fund as opposed to being a bank that extends credit just by creating it on its books, as we know is how the system works today. I mean, finally, after 100 years, they've come around to admitting that. Well, I'll just say, and because I just read your appendix and I was very impressed with the way you laid out that argument, you argued that 100% reserve solution as they've presented the model wouldn't actually change the amount of liquidity in the system. The banks would still just wind up borrowing the savings of other banks as
right.
needed, and the long-term loans, you could essentially turn them into adjustable rate loans by, you know, making them short-term loans that roll over and over. So,
right.
so you wouldn't really change the fundamentals of the system. So
right.
again,
in theory, like it's a short-term rate loan that rolls over, but the, you know, economic expectation of the firm that's using that liquidity, who's using that credit, is that it's going to roll over. So if there's an economic contraction and all of a sudden the bank says, well, we're not going to extend that loan to you again, it's just as if it has the same effect as in the current system.
Even a worse effect, because in the current system, they can get the liquidity. They can get it from the Federal Reserve if they have to.
Right.
But apparently they're, I mean, I think I've seen that in the 100% reserve proposals too, that the whatever the monetary authority is, that it could create extra credit as needed. But so you've got the same system that you have now where the banks can borrow very cheaply and lend at a much higher rate. So they're in control of who gets the money, at what rate, and how much of it is out there or how little. So we, the people, still would lose control over the money supply, which was the point of the proposal, I think.
Mm-hmm. One thing that would be different, I think, is that if you could put your money in the bank just as savings and say, well, I don't want this to be lent out. You know, I want this to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, the bank would have no financial incentive to hold your money and would therefore charge probably a fee to hold your savings, which
right.
is kind of a backdoor route to negative interest.
Mm-hmm. Which I think people would be willing to pay. I mean, they certainly are willing
right.
to pay it in Europe in order to have a safe place to put your money or a convenient place to it. It's just like you pay a percentage on PayPal, but you're willing to do it because it's so convenient to be able to just click that little PayPal box. And I don't know if you do
yes,
it.
Yes, except, of course, you know, when that if that fee got to more than 1% or 2%, people would probably start going to keep their
yeah.
money in cash.
Right.
And then you have the whole thing about, well, do you try to put some kind of demurrage rate on cash, some kind of expiry date or something like that, or abolish cash completely, which is starting to happen in some Scandinavian countries. And I mean, there's pretty much a movement around the world toward abandoning cash, which has totalitarian implications because then every transaction is recorded. But it also brings us back to an earlier and I think healthier conception of wealth. In early times, wealth was pretty much transparent. When wealth consisted in how much land or cattle or sheep or camels that you owned, everybody knew who was rich and who was not rich. You couldn't hide it, you know, in a bank account. So it was the responsibilities incumbent upon wealth were also unavoidable. You know, there was a certain social role that the wealthy person had to play. And so I think that ultimately we are moving into an age of transparency where you can't hide, and we're already seeing it with the proliferation of video cameras, that sure, there's the Orwellian dimension of that we're always being watched and monitored and tracked and surveilled, but the same thing now is being turned back toward the authorities, and we're seeing this, you know, tremendous revelation of police brutality. It's having a big impact, you know, a lot of what was invisible is coming into visibility. And I think that this trend toward transparency, which includes the personal dimension too, being authentic, being emotionally transparent, I think it ultimately will and should extend to money as well. So I think that, perhaps the move toward electronic money and toward and away from anonymous cash is part of a healthy trend and not historically unprecedented. David Graeber writes about this kind of ebb and flow through the millennia, credit to cash to credit to cash, saying that cash is much more suited for times of social disruption where there are, you know, itinerant soldiers coming through and they don't have credit because they're not going to be around any longer. But in really stable societies, you don't need cash because you can use credit, because people aren't going to disappear, because there are social networks that hold people to their word and hold them to their obligations. So, you know, to take a big picture view, I think that this war on cash isn't necessarily a bad thing. It can cut both ways. If we're if it accompanies increasing, a descent into totalitarianism, then it is certainly a wonderful tool for the totalitarians. But it also has the potential to bring us into a society that is much more transparent. Mm-hmm. I mean, what would it be like if you couldn't hide your wealth, you know?
I totally agree. I started out a book, which I haven't written and may not finish, but yeah, I use The Wizard of Oz as a theme for Web of Debt. So I was going to use 1984 and The Hunger Games as a theme for a book of what's going on now. So in 1984, you have Big Brother watching you, and Big Brother wins in the end in the movie and the book, yeah. 1984. But in The Hunger Games, the rebels turn, they use the TV, they use the monitor, the Big Brother, to their own advantage, and they use that to broadcast to everybody what's going on and to spark a movement. And I haven't seen the last one. Jamie saw it, so she won't tell me because she didn't want to ruin it for me. But I assume that the good guys win in the end. Anyway, I agree that what's wrong with this system now, I mean, say public banks, for example, people worry about, well, you're going to be giving all this power to bureaucrats who you can't trust. But if you had 100% transparency, which is possible now because of the Internet, you could trust them by law. In other words, you could force them to do their duty, just like in the Bank of North Dakota, they're audited three different ways, and you can see their books. You know, you can see exactly what they're investing in. You can see who's getting the money. And if there's some illegality there, you can sue them over that. So it seems to me that there's a lot to be said for a system that is basically a giant community currency system, like a digital community currency system, where we acknowledge that money is nothing but credit, and where you are taking out an advance against your own credit. You're not borrowing somebody else's money. You're just borrowing in a debit in your own account in the great computer in the sky, which has unlimited numbers, the potential to go into debit for anybody who has a plan that they want to materialize, and they have a vision for how they're going to do it, and they can show whoever's in charge of credit how they're going to do it. And then there's the issue of then that gives some authority the control over whether you get credit or not, but you can still go to private creditors. I mean, it wouldn't have to be the only system. But anyway, so I can see that there's a potential upside of this whole digitalization of money. Of course, I'm always pleased to see it, where you talked about public banking as a way to get over this idea of in a mutual credit clearing system. If it's a local system, you know the people and it's based on trust. But if it's what happens when it's all the way across the country and you don't know the person on the other side of your trade. And in fact, that's what we have in derivatives right now. Where that was the reason the whole thing collapsed in 2008, was that the derivatives could be sold to anonymous parties who might or might not have the money to pay up, and it turned out they didn't have the money to pay up, and they just folded those Bear Stearns hedge funds to start with instead of paying up, and then that caused this whole domino effect. Do you want to go into your concept of anonymous cyberspace and what you could do about it?
Yeah, and this gets into the issue of cryptocurrencies, which is another one of these experiments that I am happy to see just because they're an experiment. Even though I think Bitcoin, for example, is seriously flawed in its design, it's also showing us, fascinating potential. And maybe, you know, we need a system that has the, at least for the time being, the anonymity of cash alongside the benefits of transparency and social agreement and consensus that is at the foundation of credit. So perhaps the cryptocurrencies can give us that what cash gives us today. Because, you know, we're not going to wave a magic wand and eliminate the free riders and the parasites and the criminals overnight from society. Let's be realistic here.
Yeah. Well, but there are people that say that it's kind of like cockroaches. If you shine a light on them, you can move them out.
Yeah.
It's all very exciting. I mean, we're at the point of transformation. You had also written that some people say that we have to just wait for the whole thing to collapse and we're on the edge of a big crash and then, you know, wipe the slate clean and start all over. But you're envisioning more of a transformation, which is a lot more, you know, it's more soothing and comforting. But how do you envision this transformation?
I think it's actually both. I think that people are not, and especially, you know, the elites and the institutions, they're not going to make any big changes when the current system is still working, when they can still go to work that day and do the things that they did yesterday. That's just not how it's. They're not going to, you know, go to work one day and say, okay, let's try something radically different. The institutional inertia is too strong for that. Even though within the institutions, they all know that it's not working. So I think that it has to stop working, and therefore open the menu of possibilities to things that were not on the menu before. And when that happens, then perhaps some of these proposals that I write about and that you write about, which aren't actually necessarily mean tearing everything down and building a whole new system, they're very easily available. So it's a kind of a paradox. They're right in front of our face, yet they're also impossibly far away. So I think that it's going to be both. There is going to be a crisis and a complete breakdown, a moment of, oh my God, this isn't working, that mm-hmm. will shake us loose from our institutionalized habits. And then mm-hmm. and then the evolutionary, you know, transformative changes will have an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that Hollywood is exposing all these, well, like The Big Short, obviously, mm-hmm. and Wall Street, those movies, where you can see the bankers themselves being, or the traders or whatever, being very uncomfortable with the system, and they right. themselves, no doubt, would be happy to have some way out.
I was talking to a guy yesterday who's works for the state of California, doing water resource management and stuff like that, and he was describing this Byzantine system of regulations and assessments and bureaucracy and mm-hmm. environmental impact statements. And it's so dysfunctional that nothing can get done. And no one inside the system really believes in it. But everybody, he says, half the people there are paid to hold a position, like a rugby game where they're all pushing against each other. And they have to keep pushing because the other guys are pushing, but the rugby scrum never moves from the midline. And, you know, like there was something where they were going to restore a river that had been running dry because there, too much water was being taken from it, but, you know, to restore the salmon. But then it turned out there was some lizard that was living in the dry riverbed and they couldn't let the waters back in because according to their own regulations, this is an endangered lizard. And it was just this, they're just paralyzed. And he said, it's so complicated and so institutionalized that it is beyond reform. He says he thinks we just have to start over. So there, I think there is a lot that needs to be cleared away.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of discontent with the system. So people that are willing to change it, I mean, we're finding that we're attempting to get public banks set up. So you do find politicians mm-hmm. who are ready for change and bankers that are ready for change and ready to help out in some sort of change that are just sort of disillusioned with the whole system.
Yeah, and public banking seems like it's not that big a step. You know, you have.
Yeah, that's one reason I like it. You're just tweaking it a bit. I mean, basically, right. we're returning to ourselves what we should have had in the first place and what we lost. The power to create money should be a sovereign right of government. And yeah. we now know that virtually all our money is created by banks. So we need to own the banks. But speaking of which, well, the reason I started interviewing, got in contact with you was about this Wargull experiment and the negative interest, mm-hmm. where they're using negative interest as supposedly this will get people out there shopping. you know, spending their money because it'll cost them money to hold money in the bank. But it seems to me that that's sort of a bastardization of the Wergel experiment, where in the Wergel experiment, you actually put money out there first. I mean, they issued new money, and then they put a negative interest on it to encourage people to spend it. So we need some sort of a national dividend or something that gives people a floor, you know, a safety net or whatever, before you can really get into a gift economy where you can give away the extra. Right now, people don't feel like they have any extra because they don't know what's coming. And so they think, well, okay, so I have some savings, but what if I get sick and, you know, it's not covered by insurance? Or what if there's a big market crash and my savings that are now in stocks or whatever go down? So nobody feels secure, so we need some sort of, it seems to me it would have to be government, you know, something the government does. I don't know who else would do it in order to give everybody the security to know that they're not going to be homeless.
Yes.
Do you have a response?
If I had to, if I were going to rewrite Sacred Economics, I'd probably put even more emphasis on universal basic income or some version of that idea. Because right now the system, especially the retirement system, the way pensions are funded, you know, 401ks, et cetera, it depends on being able to get a risk-free positive return on investment. It depends on an interest-based system.
Mm-hmm.
And that is already, the things I wrote about in that book, they're already happening despite our best efforts to stop them. You know, interest rates have been, the risk-free interest rate has been close to zero 6 or 7 years now, right? At least, yeah. A 10-year treasury bond or something like that. And that's so different from when I was a kid. And if you had $1 million, you could invest it in interest, make $50,000 a year in interest, you know, and you were
living
set for life.
Yeah.
Like, you can't do that anymore. And, you know, imagine what that does, you know, if you're managing a pension fund. Like, the only people who have a risk-free interest rate of, you know, the 5 or 10% that it was in the old days are the people who are so large, the banks and the hedge funds that are so large that if their investments fail, they'll get bailed out. And so that's called risk-free, but it's actually just exporting the risk on everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But that old system of funding the lives of older people, of retirees, it's already broken. And if we go to a negative interest system, that problem isn't going to go away. There, like you said, there has to be a way to bring money to the people who need to spend it. The Feds and the central banks' zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing on top of that were kind of this wishful thinking attempt to say, well, if we give the people who have money enough of it, then they'll put it in the hands of people who will
spend it.
Yeah. They'll lend it out.
Lend it at interest.
But when the economy isn't growing, then there aren't very many prudent investments to make.
Mm-hmm.
There are not a lot of channels to bring the money into the economy to lend it to people who you think are going to pay back. Like, how are they going to pay it back if the economy isn't growing, if their wealth isn't going to grow over time, if that business isn't going to increase its revenue over time? You know, it's better to keep the money. So one thing that negative interest rates does is it allows lending to happen at zero interest rate. Even if I say, well, Ellen, you know, I don't see your income rising over your life, but that's okay because I'm going to lend you at zero interest, because if I keep the money, I'll get even less than zero. So I think it doesn't solve the problem of retirees, but it does redistribute wealth. But I think that also we have to do something, have some way to redistribute wealth directly. And universal basic income actually fits really well into a negative interest system, which, you know, I think would probably best work as a liquidity fee on bank reserves, because then you just take because basically you're removing money from the money supply through negative interest, and then you have to put it back somehow. And the way you put it back is just perhaps by giving it out as a universal basic income or giving it to retirees or something like that.
Yeah, I was thinking you could do like a debit card with $1,000 a month to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I've figured out the numbers, and I think all that would work, and it would stimulate the economy enough to generate enough taxes to actually return the money. But then just put a limit on it, like you have to spend it within a year. And then, so that would be the equivalent of negative interest. It decays, it expires. Yeah.
Yeah. Or if you have it on a debit card, I mean, you could just have it electronically decay.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. You wouldn't have to put stamps or anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All so easy in the digital age.
There's something really egalitarian and fair about it. It doesn't tweak conservatives in the way that welfare does because, you know, Bill Gates gets his $1,000 a month debit card too.
Right,
and he
right.
can spend it on anything he wants.
And we can show the numbers. We need that money out there. I mean, it's good for business to get some demand out there. It's like a game of Monopoly. When somebody's got all the chips, nothing happens. You've got to get the chips, the dollars or whatever. You've got to get them back out there into the system.
It's just how to do that and you know, where to take the money from.
Well, or you don't even have to take it from. You can just issue it. Yeah, don't take it away from somebody else. Just issue it.
But then you're still implicitly taking it away because you'd have inflation if you increase the money supply.
Well, but then you take it back in taxes or whatever. Well, it's been so great to talk to you, actually. Do you have a website?
CharlesEisenstein.net is my website.
Good
Thanks, Ellen. It's a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Charles Eisenstein, a popular speaker and the author of many books, including Sacred Economics, Money, Gift, and Society in the Age of Transition.
Before we close out the program today, we want to take a brief moment with some comments from the man who got the Santa Fe public banking effort underway, the late and beloved Craig Barnes. On this program back in 2014, he reflected on many of the same issues that Ellen's guest today, Charles Eisenstein, discussed, that our economy and our policies have a larger focus than temporary profit for oneself.
In the conversation originating out of Scotland, really, an attempt to discover the public good and to serve the public good, to serve something larger than self-interest. So precedent to the rise of corporations is this long-term, centuries-long conversation about how do we do good for the public? How do we serve the community? That desire to serve the public has been ridiculed in the last 30 years. It's been demeaned as if the market can serve the public, but communitarian goals or goals to take care of those least able to take care of themselves, those efforts have been demeaned in the last 30 years. And before we will get public banking in any community, we have to revive our confidence that that's the right thing to do, that it is right and proper to be trying to serve the public interest rather than selfish, narrow interest. That ethical sense has to be led by people like yourselves in the public banking effort and people who are not chained to, I think now, chained to Washington.
Craig Barnes. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.